You open your Bibles to Matthew chapter 20, and we'll be looking at the first 16 verses of this particular very interesting story. I want to talk about a jealous Thanksgiving. Are you having a jealous Thanksgiving? It's been said that if you woke up this morning with more health than illness, then you are more blessed than the 6 million people who will die around the world this week. If you've never experienced the danger of battle, the loneliness of imprisonment, or the agony of torture, you are ahead of 500 million people in the world. If you attend a church meeting without fear of harassment, arrest, torture, or death, you are more blessed than 3 billion people in the world. If you have food in the refrigerator, clothes on your back, a roof overhead, and a place to sleep, you are richer than 75% of this world. And if you have money in the bank, some money in your wallet, and some spare change in a dish someplace in your house, you are among the top 8% of the world. Think about it. We live in the top 8% of the world. And we struggle with Thanksgiving. Now, it's easier to be thankful when you don't compare yourself with someone who has more. As long as you look up and give thanks, you're okay. But you look around, and you can become envious. And when we start to compare, we'll always end up seeing someone who has more than we do, and we may struggle with that. There's always someone that's farther up the ladder than we are. And we have a way of noticing that. And we are generally envious of those closest to us in our level. For example, a pastor with 100 people doesn't envy Rick Warren with 30,000. That's just overwhelming. But a pastor of 100 people may be envious of his seminary classmate who just has a church down the road with 250. Or a farmer who has 900 acres doesn't envy the guy with 100,000. That's just way above. But he may envy his next-door neighbor who has 3,000 acres. We tend to envy those around us that are at our level, but just a little bit better. And we look and go, oh, man, are they getting so blessed? We tend to fixate on people in our category that are just doing a bit better. And here's the ironic thing. If you get to know the people you envy, you will discover they envy the people that are above them. There's always someone higher up the rung on the ladder that we are always envious of. And we often find ourselves grumbling under our breath. So what happens when we play the comparison game? Well, we lose our focus. We stop being thankful, and we start to grumble. And grumbling is a very dangerous sin for Christians. The dictionary offers these definitions for the word grumble. It means to show one's unhappiness or critical attitude. Or secondly, to make complaining remarks or noises underneath one's breath. Or thirdly, to murmur or mutter in discontent and complain sullenly. Well, I like the second definition. To make complaining remarks or noises underneath one's breath. We can smile when we see someone else become really successful, but we can also mutter underneath our breath, so why are they having all the breaks? There's many examples in the Bible of people who grumbled, particularly the children of Israel as they were leaving Egypt. They grumbled because they didn't have enough water. They grumbled because they didn't like the wilderness. And then they grumbled because they thought Moses was a bad leader. They grumbled because eventually they missed Egypt. Oh, why don't we just go back where we came from? They grumbled because they weren't seeing the promised land. They were known to be a grumbling people. The very people of God, God was rescuing and saving, were the most grumbling people. Well, how do you spot a grumbler? If you don't know whether or not you qualify as a grumbler, here are three marks of a grumbler. Number one, a grumbler is never satisfied with what he or she has. If it's money, they want more. If it's a home, they want a nicer one. Or if you're a student and you only have B+, and you're always disappointed. You become an expert in criticism, a PhD in nitpicking. Nothing is ever enough. And the first example that came into my mind as I was thinking about this message is I have an aunt, and she's still living, but she's in the senior's home now, so I'm sure she won't be listening while I'm saying this. You'll tell her. Oh, man. They lived on a little farm. This little kid, I remember that she was adamant that, you know, saying to my uncle, we got to sell this farm, got to move to town, I want a better life. So, okay, they sold the little farm up on the hill, moved to town, and immediately she made sure they had a brand new house built, and immediately they bought a brand new car, and everything was just new, and it was just so much more than any of us had. She got a job at the hospital, got a nice union job, lots of money, and they went through several houses and had a new car every year. Every year was a brand new car. Just always everything. But it was never enough. Just everything more and more. She is the most of the 19 aunts I have. She is the most unhappy. No one had newer cars. No one had a better house at that time. But just never, it was never enough. Never been. And it got so that nobody wanted to go there and visit. Such a negative atmosphere. Everything was always grumbling, always grumbling. Nobody wanted to go visit them. And then she grumbled, nobody came to visit her. There was a reason why. They're not fun people to be around. Never satisfied. Never satisfied. Secondly, a grumbler always has an excuse. Ask a man why he doesn't buy a new car. He'll say, well, the interest rates are too high. Ask him next week why he doesn't buy a new car. Well, they cost too much. Ask him a week later, why don't you buy a new car? He'll say, well, new cars are just a ripoff. There's always an excuse. So you say, well, why don't you just go buy a used car? Well, then you're just buying somebody else's problems. Well, why don't you fix your car? Well, that's just throwing good money after bad. There's always an excuse. A grumbler always has an excuse for whatever's going on in their lives. Thirdly, this might be the more subtle one. A grumbler secretly believes they will never fully succeed. I use the word secretly. Never say that out loud. But they grumble because they aren't getting what they really, really think they need. So they're never totally succeeding. Somehow the game of life is rigged. The cards are stacked against them. Try as you might, you always fall short of that happiness that's out there. So secretly, they believe they never will get there. So they have a grumbling spirit, become very negative. They don't know how to be grateful. We're going to look at some grumbling farm workers. Do you know any farm workers who are grumblers? We're going to look at some grumbling farm workers from Matthew chapter 20. And it's a parable Jesus tells us, and I find it to be a very interesting story. And in Matthew chapter 20, verse 1, we read this. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire men to work in his vineyard. Now, to understand the story, we need to know something about this landowner, this huge farmer. The first is this. He had a huge estate. He had a lot of land. He was a big-time landowner. We also know harvest had come. And time is of the essence. It's time to get it off before I just see my money going on the ground. He can't wait. He needs many workers. And he has a lot of resources. He has the money to pay his workers right up front. He's well off. He's got it all. Of course, he needs more. He needs to take care of what he has. So we know something about him. And that's not wrong. I'm just saying, well-to-do, lots of resources, needs workers. Now we need to know something about the dynamics of a marketplace in those days. The marketplace was where the unemployed would gather. They would sit there all day and they would hope that somebody from the town or the surrounding area would show up sometime that day and say, I need some hired hands, and come and hire them. So they would sit there. They would be idle all day just waiting for someone to come and hire them. So their outlook was always kind of bleak, just sitting there, just waiting for someone to come. And in this story, it's not as if they had a job, and the landowner comes and offers them a higher pay if they will leave their existing employer and follow him. No, these are people with no jobs, no money, and no hope. Anything that happens is a blessing to them. Anything. Any kind of work. Just give me some money. I need money for my family. So here's the story. Let's start with verse 1 again. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire men to work in his vineyard. He agreed to pay them a denarius for the day and sent them into his vineyard. There are five groups of people that are hired in the story. The first group is the group that got hired at 6 o'clock in the morning, early in the morning. And of course, they work from sun up till sundown. And so at about 6 o'clock in the morning, there they are, looking for someone to hire them for the day. And sure enough, some people get the opportunity to work a whole day and to get a denarius for it. They were up early. That's good. They negotiated their wages. He said, I'll do it for a denarius. That's good. They were hired first. Other people hung around, so they were lucky. That's good. And they contracted for a day's work for a denarius. That was a day's wage. So it was a fair contract. Nothing wrong. They had every reason in the world to be thankful. That's the first group, 6 o'clock in the morning. Then there's the next group that got hired. Look at verse 3 and 4. About the third hour, you have to keep in mind, back then, their clock started not at midnight, but at 6 o'clock in the morning. So when you think, well, what's the third hour? Well, that's 9 o'clock in the morning. It started at 6 o'clock in the morning, and by 9 o'clock, well, that's the third hour for them. About the third hour, he went out and saw others standing in the marketplace doing nothing. He told them, you also go and work in my vineyard, and I will pay you whatever is right. The landowner realizes very quickly, wow, this isn't going to go as fast as I would like. I need more workers. So, 9 o'clock, there he is, getting some more guys. There's more work available. That's good. These men are ready and available. That's good. The landowner promised fair pay. That's good. They aren't promised a denarius since part of the day is gone. All he says, I'm going to pay you what's fair. That's fair. That's good. That's cool. Those are the 9 o'clock workers. Now we have the 12 o'clock workers by noon. Look at verse 5. So they went, and he went out again at about the 6th hour and the 9th hour and did the same thing. So at 12 o'clock noon, he's going back for more workers. And he says he did the same thing. He offered them work and said, I will give you a fair wage. Well, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, he's assessing the situation. He says, I need more workers. Back he goes again. At 3 o'clock in the afternoon and says, I need some more workers and I'll be fair to you. So the 3 o'clock workers go, phew, at least they get a few hours in. Then there's the fifth group of people in verse 6 and 7. About the 11th hour, he went out and found still others standing around. He asked them, "Why have you been standing here all day doing nothing?" "Because no one has hired us," they answered. And he said to them, "You also go and work in my vineyard." This is 5 o'clock in the afternoon. This is 1 hour before the sun's going to go down. Well, just 1 hour? But at least it's something. They've been idle all day. Not their fault. Nobody came. And of course, he was fortunate. The landowner was fortunate to have people standing and waiting. Because he just realizes, man, I'm just falling behind with my harvest. So he offered them a drop for the last hour of the day. With one noticeable difference. All the other workers, 6 o'clock in the morning, 9 o'clock, 12 o'clock, 3 o'clock, they were all promised wages. The first ones, they knew exactly what they would get. The others told that, "Well, I'll be fair to you." These people at 5 o'clock weren't promised anything at all. He never even said, "I'm going to give you a fair wage. I just want you to come to work." There was no agreement of any kind. They just said, "Okay, we'll just come and work for the last part of the day for you." So what do we know so far? A wealthy landowner, lots of work, great harvest, he's got lots of resources to be the bunny, and he has lots of workers. Well, it's payday. At the end of the day, you got paid. So here's payday. Immediately something unusual happens. Look at verse 8. When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, "Call the workers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last ones hired and going on to the first." That was unusual. Usually the ones who worked first got paid first so they could leave. They've been there all day. It is exactly the opposite. Now, why would he pay the ones that just worked now? Why would he take the time to pay them first, forcing all the others to stand around when they've been there already all day or whatever? Is he trying to get rid of his pocket change and save the big bucks for the other workers? It appears he has something more in mind. He pays the last group, the 5 o'clock people. He pays them first in order to reveal the hidden motives of those that were hired earlier. He's going to show them something about their heart. He's going to teach them a lesson. Only the first group, the 6 o'clock in the morning, they were the only ones that had actually had a contract for a certain amount of money. All the others worked by faith. They weren't told with it. It was just by faith. The landowner wants the first group to see how generous he's going to be with those who had no agreement at all. Now comes the kicker of the story. Look at verse 9. And the workers who were hired at about 11th hour, the ones that were hired at 5 o'clock, they just worked an hour before the sun went down, came and each received what? They received a denarius. Wow, that's quite a wage for 1 hour. That's a whole day's wage. They worked 1 hour. They got a whole day's wage. Can you imagine what the 6 o'clock people are thinking? Whoa, he's in a good mood today. If these 5 o'clock workers are getting a denarius, a whole day's worth for 1 hour, he's obviously in a good mood, and they can hardly wait for their turn. Because can you imagine they're going, a denarius for 1 hour? That means we should be getting 12 denarius. 12 days worth a day of wages for 12 hours of work. At least by the standard they're observing, this is what they should be getting. But here's the shock of the story. Verse 10. So when those who came who were hired first They expected to receive more. I mean, they're just seeing what's happening. They're going, hey, wow, their ship came in today. Must be a good harvest. He's feeling good. But each one of them also received a denarius. If you were one of the 6 o'clock morning workers, how would you have felt? How would you feel? You'd probably feel the same as these guys did. Look at verse 11. When they received it, they began to grumble against the landowner. I got to be honest with you. I sympathize with them. That's not fair. Look how long we worked and we don't get any more than those guys that work an hour. I mean, you work hard. You sacrifice to get the job done. You keep your part of the bargain. And some airhead waltzes in, works an hour, and gets as much. Something's rotten in Denmark. This isn't fair. That doesn't seem right, does it? Verse 12. These men who were hired last worked only 1 hour, they said. And you made them equal to us who have borne the burden of the work and the heat of the day? Or rather, being thankful for a day of work and a day's wage, now they are grumbling. Now what's at the heart of their complaint? The heart of their complaint is verse 12. These men who were hired last and worked only 1 hour, they said, and here's the kicker. You made them equal to us. Man, that ticks us off. You made them equal to us. That's what fired them up. I mean, count the hours we worked. We're not equal. Who endured the heat of the day? They're not equal. Who bore the burden of the work? They're not equal. Something is very wrong. And the 6 o'clock morning workers, they don't mind that the 5 o'clock workers are getting paid. They don't even mind that they're paid 1 denarius, but they're just complaining then that they didn't get more. That's why in verse 10, so when those who came were hired first, they expected to receive more. That's why they grumbled. They were thankful at first, but now they're having a jealous Thanksgiving. Someone has put this into summary form like this. First, there was observation. They saw the latecomers getting paid. Then there was expectation. They assumed they would then be paid more. Then there was consternation. They couldn't believe what was happening. And then there was detonation. They blew up. Said, whoa, this isn't fair at all. On the surface, it appears to be reasonable to be grumbling. But it's based on a standard of human comparison. Ultimately, they were not complaining against the other workers. Their complaint was against the landowner. You are not fair. But it's the landowner who had hired them in the first place. Without the landowner, they wouldn't have had a job. The landowner wasn't unfair. He held his end of the bargain. He gave them a full day's wage for a day's work. It just happens to be that others got some extra. That's what ticked these guys off. The 6 a.m. workers didn't like that the 5 p.m. workers were made equal to them on the pay scale. So when you look at that story, you look at their reaction, we see two problems in the story. One is this. we are rooting for the wrong side. It's not hard to feel sympathy for the 6 a.m. workers, but Jesus knew that we would instantly root for the wrong side. What's the cause of their grumbling? Envy. They're jealous. It's the belief that others are getting what they don't deserve, that we're not getting what we deserve, if this is the case, if this is the picture. In comparison, we work so hard and receive so little, and they work so little, and they got so much. Suddenly, we go from gratitude for what we got to envy for what they didn't deserve. They don't deserve that. They don't deserve that. We deserve what we got. Contract. They don't deserve it. And then suddenly start getting jealous. So we're rooting for the wrong side. Rather than rejoicing with the 5 p.m. workers, we're feeling sorry for the 6 a.m. workers. That's how it usually is in human nature. We root for the wrong side. Secondly, behind it all, we have a problem with God. Just like the grumblers had problems with the landowner, our problem is not so much with people as it is with God. We're mad at God because we think He was better to those people than He was to us. The purpose of the story is to teach us about God. God is not only a God of justice. The landowner was just in his dealings with the 6 a.m. people. He was just. He was fair. We not only serve a God of justice, but we serve a God of grace. But those who came so much later got the same rewards. Really, we've got a problem with God when we start looking and comparing ourselves with people. Thereby, we'll overestimate our importance and underestimate His grace to this world. This really probes at our motives. What makes us be happy or not happy? What makes us want to go to work or not go to work? What makes us respond the way we do? I'll never forget, it was in the late 60s, and I'm well old enough to remember the story and to see my dad's reaction. We were a very small farm. And so, a couple miles down the road, my Uncle Pete, who was a very successful farmer, and back then if you had a, probably was a 3-ton truck, that was considered a big grain truck back then. We just had a lonely little half-ton to do everything, all the hauling. So Uncle Pete would bring all his grain every day in his 3-ton truck, international truck, and he would have our humble little Chevy half-ton and have a half-ton full of wheat and bring it to the elevator. And at least in my dad's estimation, the elevator man always ripped him off. Of course, which farmer doesn't say that? He thought we had good wheat with the elevator man, and he would say, oh, that's just number 3 wheat. My dad said, no, that's number 1. That's just number 3. And he always felt he got ripped off. Well, Uncle Pete was a very good farmer. He had a lot of number 1 wheat. But he had one particular field that didn't do well at all, and that was number 3 wheat. My dad was also helping Uncle Pete haul grain. Well, he noticed when a farmer in front of him, of course they all lined up, waiting to take their turn at the elevator, he knew the operation well, he knew the owner well, and he would stand there and watch these guys pulling up with their 3-ton trucks, number 1 wheat. And then he pulled up with his lonely little Chevy half-ton, and we'd shovel off the little bit of wheat we had. They went into the same hopper as all the other number 1 wheat. But he got paid for number 3. What had his feelings? But there is nothing to do. My Uncle Pete was behind him. And he was hauling in some number 3 wheat. But because he already hauled in some number 1 wheat, the elevator man said, well, you know, you hauled in so much number 1, I'll just kind of mix your number 3 with my number 1. It'll, it, you know, it won't really make a big difference in the bin. And so my Uncle Pete got number one price for number 3 weeks. Was my dad rejoicing? Nope. He had a jealous Thanksgiving. He was jealous of his brother-in-law. But he was particularly angry at the elevator man. That left a real impression on my young mind. What my dad was grappling with, it's like, it's not fair. It's just not fair. And a lot of us deal with that. Things happen, we go, it's not fair. And ultimately, we don't want to admit it, but ultimately, when we say it's not fair, who ultimately are we pointing our finger to? God. Saying, God, why did you let this happen? This is really your fault. Why did you not come to my rescue and give me what I think I really deserve? Deep down, if we're not happy, it's because of our attitude to God. God, it's your fault. If you hadn't allowed this to happen, you hadn't done this, this, and this, it's always God's fault in the end, in our own minds. We've had a good year this year. It sounds to me like our farmers have had a record yield. Literally the best crop ever. It's been a good year. Our gardens are good. There have been some just very luscious gardens out there. It's been a great year for our gardens. You look at the people at High River who got government assistance. Charitable organizations, NGOs came in, helped out with all the victims. And here too, they have to be careful. Because you could have one guy who gets a really good response from the insurance company. And they'll say, yeah, we'll pay everything. Then you have the next guy from another insurance company. No. We'll give you a little bit of, you know, help for maybe some damage in the main floor, but basement, no, we're not covering your basement at all. This guy feels ripped off. But the guy next door, he's getting complete reimbursement. You're just going to give me a few bucks for the carpet in my house? I'm going to lose everything in my basement? And so you start comparing, you go, but look at the break they get. Look what I got to live with. Suddenly, when you start looking around, you go, it's not fair. And you're hearing it all over. It's not fair. And ultimately, they have to deal with God about this. So they have to look up to God. Either accept what God allowed to happen to their lives, or if they reject it, they have a problem with God. And believe me, when you have a problem with God, you're not going to win. You're not going to win. It really tells us what how we look at God through our stuff. Do we just accept that God is just and fair? Do we grumble? All of a sudden, someone gets extra blessings. Go, that's not fair. So what is the cure for a grumbling heart? If I am having a jealous Thanksgiving, what's the cure? I don't know if I have one. I'll try. I wrestle with this just like anyone else. Somebody doesn't work as hard, or work as hard, but they just get more. And you just got to just lean back in and go, whoa, you got to come to God. Because that's the only place you can resolve it. It's number one. Earnestly thank God for the blessings you've already experienced. Don't look around. Don't compare. Just look at what you have and ask yourself, do I have enough? Do I have enough? If I have enough, surely I can say thank you. And if I think I don't, I can still thank him because he has promised to meet all my needs. But if I just look at my own stuff, look up, it's a lot easier to be thankful than to look around. So before you grumble today, start by thanking God earnestly for all the blessings in your life. Those 6 a.m. workers, they got exactly what they deserved. They got exactly according to the contract. There was nothing wrong with the contract, nothing wrong with the work. God is telling us, whatever you get, be thankful, don't look around, be prepared. Just thank God. Second, realize that we are all recipients of God's generous grace. There's a reason for the story. That is this. I thought about this for a while before I was going to say it. I really struggled about it actually till this morning, actually. Am I really going to say, do I really believe this? Grace makes us all equal. Grace makes us all equal. It is by the grace of God that the 6 o'clock workers got work. Someone else could have been picked and they would have stood there most of the day. And had they been a 5 o'clock worker, boy, would they have been happy then? You bet they would. It was all grace that they got work in the first place. It is grace that it was a landowner who was true to his word and actually paid him. It was grace that there was work. Everything falls under grace. It is by the grace of God that we have any blessings at all. It was grace that gave the 6 o'clock workers jobs, and it is grace that gave the 5 p.m. workers a hefty paycheck. It's all grace. That's why we have verse 12. Look at verse 12. This is the key to grace. This is the key to grace. These men who were hired last worked only 1 hour. And they said, "You have made them equal to us." Ah, there it is. We thought we had an advantage. And suddenly, we're just equals. We're just equals. That's the kingdom of God. You accept Jesus as a child, and you faithfully walk with God, and you say no to sin, you say no to some of the addictions, you say no to some of the habits, you say no to some of the experiences, and all the stuff some of your other friends are doing who aren't Christians. And you faithfully serve God all your life, and you serve until you're 80, 90 years old. Faithfully. And then one of those party animals gets saved at age 80, and they get just as much grace as you did when you were 5. Now, is it fair? It's just very generous on God's part, because that's who God is. God is a God of grace. And grace makes us equal. When we come before God, there aren't going to be this section who've been saved 90 years and then 80 years and 60 years and 40 years. And then way back, well, there's some people that got saved just before the rapture, before they died. No, the grace of God covers us all. We're all equals at the feet of Jesus. It's all grace. Grace makes us equal. That's why we believe in democracy. Every person has an equal vote. We're all the same. Under the grace of God. You come to church, one person, one vote. Not the pastor, he gets 5 ballots, and the elders get 4, and some of those get 3, and some of you just get 1 ballot when we vote. No. It's just all the same. Grace makes us equal. Oh, grace of God. That's what causes us to be thankful. Grace makes us equals. Last thing to remember, and I close with this. Remember that God rewards faithfulness and not production. Our world puts a premium on production. What's the bottom line? How many calls did you make? How many books have you written? How many years of university do you have? We flaunt production. And so the world looks at production, but the Lord looks at motives. The world says, what did you do? Jesus says, or asks, why did you do it? The world says, what's the bottom line? Jesus says, were you doing it for me? And then I like this one. The world says, show me your stuff. Jesus says, show me your heart. Show me your heart. That's why we're all equals under the grace of God. To have a happy Thanksgiving without jealousy, remember, God is fair, no one will be underpaid. But God is also generous. There will be a lot of surprises out there. Let's stand for closing prayer, and then we'll close with a hymn. As we said. Thank you, Lord, for showing us what the kingdom of God is like. The moment we say yes to Jesus, wow, all of heaven is our inheritance. And I inherit as much in Christ, last breath of yes, as those who said yes 70 years ago. Thank you for the abundance of grace. God, may we be people of grace. May we be generous with people who don't deserve for us to be generous. Because that is the spirit of Christ. Yes, help us to be fair. But help us also to be generous. God, in the end, we're grateful. It's not just about you being fair, because if it was about being fair, we wouldn't get anything. We wouldn't deserve it. It really is all grace. So I just pray that you would just really inhabit our Thanksgiving today, this weekend, and the days ahead, that we may bask anew the abundance of what it means to be loved by God and the joy there is in being a lover of God for God in His community. In Jesus' name.